Well, hello and welcome back to the channel. For those of you who've been here before, this is going to be a new format, a way that I'm going to do response videos to kind of hopefully streamline things. I saw Metatron doing this, and it seemed like a smart way to go, especially with things like what we're going to do today. That Jason Brashears guy, Archaics, not exactly my favorite person on the planet. Every time I try to talk to him, he calls me all kinds of names and he flat out says, you're part of a government conspiracy. So anyway, we'll do some response videos like this. We just kind of sit and respond to his video. And if you are somebody who's a member of the channel or a Patreon supporter, you will have seen this already or have access to the raw footage. And for the rest of you, you're going to get to see the edited down version. So let's get on into Crazy Archaics and his beautiful theories that are totally based in reality. Hi, my name's Dan, and welcome to Dunking.
There is an object hidden in the sky. Our predecessors studied its appearances. Like a vast clockwork apparatus, it appeared on a fixed timeline and disappeared whole civilizations.
That is a pretty good hook off the get-go, but you know, I don't think that this is going to be a... I shouldn't judge a guy so harshly, should I? Jesus Christ. But you know, that's in all honesty, this is kind of... having talked to him, this sounds a whole lot more like a sales pitch that's going to be a shuck and jive. But in all honesty, there are things in the sky that are very intriguing, that are mysterious. So I should give him the benefit of the doubt instead of being so skeptical because of our past dealings. All right, carry on.
They have left us records of this invisible eye in the sky and how they hid underground from its face. They feared the return of the Phoenix.
Yes, the return of the Phoenix. He likes to equate everything with a handful of stuff. He's very he's kind of one of those unified theory of everything types. If he was a physicist, he'd definitely be in that boat. But he's more of the just kind of unified theory of everything, man. It's all one, brah. That's his
way. The man who would be known as Charles Fort was born in Albany, New York on August 6, 1874. He died in the Bronx on May 3, 1932, almost 58 years old. In ordinary longevity, Charles Fort was anything but normal. One of the last of a dying breed of rogue intellectuals, Fort was a thinker.
For those of you who don't know who Charles Fort is, which is probably a lot of people, he's a pretty interesting dude. I like Charles Fort quite a bit, so I was surprised to see that he referenced him right off the bat. But Charles Fort was, he ended up building stronger theories throughout life. But as he began in the early days, he was basically just throwing rocks at scientific dogma. And that's really where I love the dude, because I mean, he would call out scientists ignoring data. And if for those of you who've watched me before, that's right up my alley.
What science has failed to do for itself, he has done for the layman. Fort's legacy is preserved today in 1,054 pages of his continually republished books. Between London's British Museum archives and the New York Public Library, he spent 27 years amassing the most unusual compilation of historical data ever released to the public.
Yeah, the data that he gathered was, I mean, he was eclectic about it. He was very much, again, theory of everything type of dude. So he was all like, he's researching earthquakes and researching raining frogs is like one of the big things they talk about a lot. He believed that at points in Mars having like massive influence over humanity, just all kinds of like insanity, basically, the way he would glue all these different things together. And again, the man, he was cynical and funny. So when you read his stuff, it doesn't come across very serious. Like his hypotheses always come in second place. Basically, his big takeaway is fuck science, fuck the scientific method, fuck scientists. And that's not exactly accurate, but that was really where you would come at it and just be like, these guys just get it all wrong. And so he was really, a lot of people didn't like him. But he was very well loved by a lot of people, and some of his friends even would say that he didn't really know he didn't really seem to take his stuff seriously. He took the idea that science was getting shit wrong seriously.
He stands as a pillar of erudition, impervious to any weight of criticism, for his source materials are impeccable. The Proceedings of the Academy of Natural Sciences, American Antiquarian Archaeological Journal, British Astronomical Association, the Carnegie Institute, Chemical News, Comps Rendus, Edinburgh Review, Essex Naturalist, Geological Magazine, Intellectual Observer, Journal of Asiatic Society, Knowledge. These are just a few.
That doesn't mean it's impeccable. I mean, his takeaway is, you know, you can bring a lot of data in and say, well, this data is perfect, but then your takeaway can be all kinds of messed up with it, right? So, like a great example would be if you just made a law that said that people that played Magic the Gathering got to steal from people that didn't. Then all of a sudden you would have this massive disparity in theft. It looked like magic nerds were thieves, but that wouldn't be the case, would it? It would just be that you opened the floodgates and facilitated it. So you always have to be able to look at these statistics need to be viewed in the proper light to sound like a bullshit academic. And so my point here is, like, you know, I don't want to confine somebody to the way they look at the statistics. And the dude's looking at these unified theories of everything. I mean, he's all across the fucking board. So you can't really try to restrain him. At the same time, I definitely raise an eyebrow. The idea that all of his some of his data was he cherry picked shit, man, because he had predetermined ideas.
Of his four books, there are three we are concerned with. Fort's Astronomical and Geological Data span 833 pages of documented reports, witness accounts, and studies in the Book of the Damned, published in 1919, New Lands, published in 1923, and Low, 1931. The collected material spanning 334 years, from the year 1597 to the year 1931. Fort cataloged thousands of findings, events, observations, and discoveries from around the world. Amazingly, in this 334-year stretch of history, there is only one small period noted by him as distinct from all the rest, 1901, 1902, and 1903.
This is what I was getting at earlier about the whole, the way you look at data. Like, Fort was a young man in the 1901, 1902, 1903 range. And yes, there was a lot of goofy shit that happened, and I'm sure that we're going to talk about that to a degree. But this was, you know, there was a lot of goofy shit happening for quite a long time. And the world was getting smaller at this point. This is, you know, radio communication was happening. People were no longer separated by the oceans the way they were not too long before. So, you know, it's like the doomsday people when they say we're getting more earthquakes, we're getting more tornadoes. It's like, well, yeah, but we also, every single one, it was like there was a time when an earthquake or a tornado down in Chile would have never made my radar. And now it's like it all has to do is like shake two goats off of their little pedestals and I'm going to hear about it. So in those regards, things are a lot different. And that's been happening since those times. You know, it's a very human thing to live in the day or to believe that your time is the day that the end of the world's going to happen. It's always, the predictions are always about your day, right? Nostradamus isn't talking 500 years from now. Nostradamus is talking about right now. You know, the Bible wasn't talking about 1,000 years from now. It's talking about right now. And that's even, that can be argued even by some interpretations of 666 as 616, which would be Nero, which would make sense for the people contemporary to the writing of Revelation. He would probably be the guy they would think was the freaking Antichrist, right? So, again, you look at it through the lens of the time.
Very specifically, 1902. These years are noted in all three books and receive more of his attention than any other time period. To Fort, the prophet of the unexplained, these 3 years were not merely visited with unusual localized phenomena, but were worldwide as well as interplanetary in scale. Ford notes that in 1902 appeared a strange new star, a light-reflecting body. Newtonian astronomy, unable to account for what was clearly observed in 1902, this star was quickly forgotten on the principle that what cannot be readily explained need be readily ignored.
You know, I've heard vague reports of this, but I've never seen anything substantial. And so I'll do a little bit of a digging into this here. So I had to look it up because I don't know everything, but apparently science records the new star from 1901 as, what did it say here, Nova Persei? G.K. Persei, which was a nova. So, yeah, a nova, for those of you who aren't aware, isn't just a PBS special. It's an exploding star. Boom. So that would make it where you potentially didn't see the pinpoint, but you certainly see the big thumb smudge. So that was probably where the new star comes from.
Unable to assail Ford's sources and unwilling to entertain his conclusions, the academic community bullied him with silence. A pillar to the laity, he was poisoned to learn. An oracle of insight.
He wasn't abused with science, or it was like the fact of the matter is he was ignored by a lot of people because his theories were crazy, man. Okay, like for those of you who don't know what the Sargasso Sea is, Sargasso Sea is this area out in the Atlantic that, like, near the Caribbean, that water just kind of goes in the same little circle, and it's really calm, and so there's a lot of seaweed that grows there, and it's been the subject of all kinds of, like, myths. Like, Columbus was afraid that his boat was going to get stuck there, and ever since then, it has been a big talking point, right, that you got Sargasso Sea is a scary place that catches ships, and you got to beware. Well, Fort believed there is a Sargasso Sea up in the sky, no shit, and this is where the frogs got caught, and leaves got caught, and blood, and then it rains, and these things come down from this space Sargasso Sea he thought that we were controlled by Martians and shit, right? I mean, you have to understand that he's positing things that can't even come close to being scientifically tested, all right? And then you can't really expect scientists to weigh in on that. I mean, they can't really say a whole lot, except for to kind of look at it and roll their eyes. So I get where there's a lot of skepticism to his work. But and again, he was combative to scientists, so there's that. But the competition to scientists they earned.
By ignored into obscurity. In the beginning of the Book of the Damned, he wrote, "In this book, I assemble some of the data that I think are of the falsely and arbitrarily excluded, the data of the damned. I have gone into the outer darkness of scientific and philosophical transactions and proceedings, ultra respectable, but covered with the dust of disregard. I have descended into journalism. I have come back with the quasi-souls of lost data. We take the position that our data have been damned upon no consideration for individual merits," unquote. What offended the scientific establishment more than anything were Fort's conclusions. He said other worlds were near to this Earth's surface. He also said vast celestial vagabonds have been excluded by astronomers because they have not been seen so very often. However, light or dark, they have been seen and reported so often that the only important reason for their exclusion is they just don't fit in.
Honestly, this is where you could see why they don't take him so seriously. You know, you start positing, you start saying that there's things in the sky that people don't see or that aren't, you know, being properly recorded. It's one thing to say, you know, there's, and Fort did talk about, like, the Nuremberg plate, right, where you got the little aliens flying in the sky and shit, and the report is like 15, 13 or something. These kinds of things, it's one thing to cite something like that and say, what happened? Wonder what's going on here. It's another thing altogether to say, this means there was another celestial body close to the Earth. And, you know, I've heard this one before. People talk about like Jacob's Ladder or Yggdrasil or these things being like the world tree, the axis being a metaphor for like us being in a locked thing with Venus in some cases, the moon in others. I've heard others as Nibiru, but it's always the same idea that like locked into such a place that there was a way that you could travel between these two worlds easily. Maybe they were really close and we had the tech or something. And these ideas are really interesting, but you also have to understand that like, at a scientific level, you've got some real fucking huge problems to look at. You start saying that, you know, there was another rock that was really close to the planet Earth not too long ago. That, you know, this it's hard because on the one hand, it's easy to not trust scientists in general when you see some scientists doing some shitty stuff. But the fact of the matter is, it just like to return to the baseball metaphor, just like there's certain teams and there's certain legacies, there's a certain fields that have these problems too. You know, the mathematicians, they're savages. They're brutal on each other. And yeah, they'll kick out a lot of goofy theories that will only because they only deal with math. But they'll be quick to tell you that, you know, these are purely mathematical constructs. There's other fields where the people really get like, they get out there, man. Like I know a person that works in neurosurgery and does a lot of brain scans. And she says that psychologists and psychiatrists drive her up the wall because she'll show them hard data. And they'll be like, yeah, but you see, I got this theory and you know, your brain scan. Yeah, I understand that that's what's actually happening on a physical level. But, you know, I'm thinking over here that maybe. And so, you know, in those fields, they're not doing anything a whole lot different than Fort. They're just kind of making shit up as they go. And that's where Fort was so hilarious in my mind. That's why I like him so much, because he just came in there and he's just like, I can play your game too. Which is kind of funny because we got Jason over here taking this, like, what many of Fort's contemporaries believed was deliberate trolling, basically, deliberate bullshit. I forget the one quote. I'll have to look it up because it's hilarious. But there's one of his contemporaries called him like the king of fools or something like that. Like he was a deliberate cynic and an asshole. He was a troll. So to see Jason taking that stuff seriously is a little bit LOL.
To so confidently publish these assertions induces us to again examine some more of Charles Fort's amazing resources. The London Royal Society Proceedings, the Magazine of Natural History, Manual of Astronomy, Meteorology, National Geographic Magazine, North American Review, Popular Astronomy, Popular Science, Monthly, Records of Geological Society, Reliquary, Science, Scientific American, U.S. Geological Survey, The Weekly Dispatch. Our appraisal of the value of Charles Fort's research dictates that we must review it chronologically.
Before we start a chronological review of his work, I think we should take a quick look at the hypocrisy involved in saying these scientists don't know anything, these scientists ignore things, these scientists get things wrong, and then say, ah, but look where he gets his data from. Science, 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 and list the stuff off like it's this litany of I understand that, you know, that pretty much everybody in science and outside of science, that in this whole, everybody likes to cherry pick things to support their pet hypothesis. But unfortunately, that's not really a road forward or a road to truth. As a matter of fact, if your standards are this scientist agrees with me, ergo, I like this scientist's work, I'm going to have to put you in the same category as I do a religious fanatic or a political nut job. That's like you're letting other things skew the data to the point you're not even looking at it properly. And those kinds of people, there's a number of people I've spoken about. One guy who's crying and whining and wanting to debate me as well, but then he just hides, just like this Jason guy. By the way, Jason, he wanted to debate me. I said, okay, I'll debate you. Then he kept calling me all kinds of names. So I, said, quit calling me names and let's just, you know, fucking do this. Then he blocked me, said that he's just going to make a video about me, and then he unblocked me. He still has me blocked. He says that he wants to anybody. He's twisted this into him not canceling the debate. So I don't trust the guy. He's a nut job, which is why the engaging is happening here. And now after watching this much of, you know, the video, it's like it's very clear. Like he's really misrepresenting Ford. I'll put it this way: Ford wouldn't be rolling in his grave over Jason, like, seriously listing a bunch of scientific sources and saying, "Oh, look at what a great guy Fort was." Fort would be sitting there smirking, going, "Gotcha."
On February 13th, 1901, a deep greenish-yellow cloud canopy spread intense darkness over the whole of France. On the 16th, over Michigan in the United States, the wind died and a brown dust-like vegetable matter fell from the sky, bringing extreme coldness. On the 18th, observers in two different areas of London saw what appeared to be a comet, and a red substance fell with the snow near Mildenhall, England. Pigeons were even seen to eat it.
Yes, and these are exactly the kinds of things that Charles Fort focused on, because there was a few years of weird astronomical phenomena, the raining of frogs and shit, and in 1901, 1902, 1903, there was quite a bit of fire in the sky stuff. And Fort talked a lot about Australia, and there's a few other places, but it seems like, if I remember right, like Australia was one of the places that he, because Australia had this weird like mud rain that year, the kind of dust bullshit that was like blowing from the center, and it was bad. And then there was meteor strikes. There was like multiple meteor strikes. So it is like this big Fort wasn't pulling your leg when he says there was some crazy shit going down. On the flip side, it's like the crazy shit that was going down wasn't exactly it wasn't a phoenix. I've seen, but anyway, yeah, the Fort was really fun that way. So I'm not surprised that Jason is, you know, talking about that stuff. But
second, 1901, a new star appeared in the heavens in the Perseus constellation, seen by Americans, Europeans, and as far as Kiev in Russia. All northern hemisphere. Astronomers asserted that a spectrographic analysis revealed that this new star to be 300 light years away, and the newspapers picked up the story. But to the embarrassment of the astronomers, the newly appeared celestial body shot out nebulous rings that moved at a rate of 2 3/7 seconds of arc a day. This far exceeded the speed of light, demonstrating that the object was much closer to the Earth than the astronomers had believed.
Yeah, this is Nova Persei again. So, I mean, this is... this is in how you represent the information. And, you know, we know a lot more. It's over 100 years since then. And, you know, we've had Einstein weigh in on this stuff. We've had Hawking's weigh in on this stuff. We got Kaku and all these other crackpots out there right now weighing in on it. We know so much more about astronomy than we did 100 years ago. So I'm not surprised that, you know, this was unknown back then, but now it's we've seen it. This, so anyway, it's just kind of, once again, it's funny. It's like, for all of his, everybody says that this guy's done some amazing research, but I'm looking at it so far, and this guy just misunderstands trolling and then doesn't understand, like, doesn't bother to look into like basic stuff.
Well, Fort wrote, when a new star in Perseus appeared in February 1901, it was just a point of light. Something went out from it, giving it 6 months a diameter equal to half of the apparent diameter of the moon. The appearances looked structural. Fort believed the dusts of 1901 and 1902 that fell on Earth from space came from this object. He notes that 3 years earlier, Dr. Ebsen, on January 16, 1898, observed something that looked like a cloud in the constellation Perseus.
Dude, the idea that this some space rock was raining dust down on us. I mean, this is stuff out of science fiction movies. There's, you know, that doesn't debunk it clearly, but it's so difficult to even know what to say to that. It's like, you can't have objects passing that close to us without them ripping the planet apart. And this is where people, I know some people believe in the electric universe theory, and I've had people comment and tell me that Jason here believes in that we all live in a simulation, which I guess that would probably explain why he takes Fort seriously, because then everything's are disconnected, and maybe there is a Sargassosea up in the sky just right. Is fucking the it's just put everything in the register and then it just spits it back out. God damn it, dude.
Dr. Epson wrote, whatever it was, it had the peculiar property of dimming and blotting out the stars. It moved into Perseus and then it moved away. On March 10th, 1901, only 16 days after the appearance of this object in the sky, a great amount of red dust fell from the sky on Sicily, Tunis, Italy, Germany, and Russia. A thick orange-red stain was reported from Ongar, Essex, England. In Austria, while the dust fell, the earth quaked. On March 11th, as dust rained on Tunis, earthquakes afflicted Algeria.
I know this is probably going to be hard for some people that follow Jason and are thinking that, you know, I have no idea what to say to the man's brilliance to keep up with, but maybe the earthquakes caused the dust and not a magic space rock. Just going to put that out there.
March 12th, ashes fell from the sky at Avellino, Italy, a new star in Perseus. Dust rains on the earth. Academia is quiet. Charles Fort, ever the philosopher in his findings, wrote, we substitute acceptance for belief. The more firmly established, the more difficult to change. And this was the problem with the scientific establishment. To Fort, to believe firmly in anything is to impede development. He maintained the existence of unknown planets and that dusts were, quote, things cast out in what is called space by convulsions of other planets, unquote. Conclusion drafted before the year 1919, we are again in awe of some of his source materials. The American Academy of Sciences, the Annals of Scientific Discovery, the Bulletin of Seismographic Society, Chambers Journal, Cosmos, Edinburgh.
Fuck. Oh, this hurts. Okay. Yes, once again, the way, we're in awe of his sources. It's like, the sources don't mean shit if the conclusion that you put together is just all jacked up. And he deliberately jacked up his conclusions. I don't know how many times I have to say it. I feel like I'm going to end up just beating that drum a bunch. But yeah, Fort did not take his shit seriously, man, at least not according to his friends. So you can't come on. And I know you're going to say that the earthquakes, I know the skeptics will be saying the earthquakes were caused by these planets passing close that rained dust down. And again, man, okay. You know why we have heat shields on a space shuttle and rocket ships and all that shit? You think dust makes it through the fucking atmosphere? Now, if they're dropping big rocks, then yeah, it could rain dust. It could rain dust from big rocks exploding in the atmosphere. And there were meteor strikes at this time. So I get where he's going with this. This is, you know, Fort put this together a while ago. And again, I'm familiar with the man's work. But when the conclusion ends up so outlandish with it, it's like, this is where you get to that, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And this is where I'm going to guess at this point that this is going to be some Nibiru thing. There's going to be some ghost planet that comes around every so often, and that Jason here is going to have labeled it the Phoenix. You know, I gathered the Phoenix title from the thing, and so I had to put the Pokemon in the thumbnail. But this is me watching this in real time, sadly. Fucking the Dust Bowl, the whole Grapes of Wrath shit, where the whole damn center of the United States was just gutted from dust. It's like this happens pretty regularly. And again, like, this could have been like there. This could, back in those days, we had the Tunguska event. You know, it took a long ass time for us to find when that rock fell. Long time. It was like, I forget how long, weeks or months. And at any rate, when that's the kind of world that you're in, when things happen in a corner that you're not aware of for a while, it's not unthinkable that something causes a dust storm, that something causes a mud rain, a mud flood. Oh, man, there we go. I got the Tartarian people all happy now. Yes, According to Charles Fort, there was a mud flood. Oh, shit.
Annual Registrar, the Encyclopedia Britannica, The Field, Gloucester, I guess it's Gloucester Journal, Human Nature, the Journal of British Astronomical Association, L'Année Scientifique.
So good.
Magazine of Science.
Yep.
Nature Magazine.
Yep.
As in 1901, we find that the events of 1902 were also preceded by a few weeks by the appearance of a new star, this time in Gemini, as seen from South Africa. This was on the 16th. In April and May 1902, across a zone of this Earth, also outside the zone, there were disturbances. More than Earth-wide relations are indicated, according to Ford. Ford itemizes a long list of these events.
Hey, I'm going to go out on a limb and say we're looking at another nebula here, looking at another nova, excuse me. And this is just, all right. If we're going to go down these kinds of hypothetical rabbit holes, you really end up having to bring more to the table than we don't know what happened with this, that, or the other thing. This isn't much of an argument. We have the best way I could basically show you where I'm looking at. There's an old skeptics argument that's a joke, but a husband and wife are on a train and they're getting ready to eat eclairs. And the husband takes a bite of the eclair just as they go into a tunnel. And he screams and grabs his wife's hand and says, "Honey, don't eat these. They make you go blind." Just because two things correlate doesn't mean that they have any collaboration at all. I mean, it doesn't mean that there's any cause and effect. So, you know, this is where, again, Fort was a fucking troll. And this is where his arguments were so funny. And some of the stuff he probably did believe to a degree, but he changed his beliefs so heavily. And, dude, okay. This guy had like beliefs that the Martians were like controlling us at one point, mind controlling us. The Martians were responsible for this dust from the sky. I mean, this guy was all over the damn place, but one thing he wasn't was serious. And he himself, he even said one of his quotes that he told one of his buddies was something along the lines of, "I don't." Like when he quit writing fiction, because he started out writing fiction, he's like, I don't write fiction anymore, or do I, or some shit like that. It's like he basically just was like, I just fucking write, man. It is what it is. For those of you who are familiar with the much later work of Hunter S. Thompson, it's basically the same kind of thing. It was like he's blurring the line so heavily that you can tell that there's a joke and you can tell it's funny, but that there's at some point where you're like, well, I mean, what is really opinion here and what's not? And, well, Jason bit right into that hook.
Volcanic eruptions of Mount Pelee, Martinique, at, I can't pronounce this, La Saphir on St. Vincent, and an earthquake in Siberia as mud fell from the sky in Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, and in Connecticut in North America. On May 7th, the sky over France turned black. Soot and water like ink fell upon Park St. Maur. On May 10th, a great number of highly colored objects like little suns were seen in the sky over South Devon.
Okay.
Later in May, in 1902, spectacular New York showers occurred over the West Indies. Earthquake shocks occurred in Spain and France, and volcanic eruption in Mexico, quakes in the Fiji Islands, and Vaya Quake in Iceland, and a volcanic eruption at Cook's Island, Alaska. In Rangoon, Burma, it just so happened that the most terrible storm that ever occurred was remembered. A remarkable meteor seen in Calcutta and in Java, the Raung volcano erupted as rumbling came from an extinct volcano in the country of France.
Wow. All right. Yeah, this isn't much in the way of evidence. So I'm going to like double time it through a big chunk of it here until we find something that has some semblance of, it's not more of the same. Okay, it's fucking, you know, how many of the same damn troll memes do I need to see? Oh, there's a bunch of black smoke in a volcano. Yep. Gee, no shit. Really? I mean, you know how much ash fell over Washington State when Mount St. Helens popped back when I was five? The whole damn, like, we came up here to visit later that year because I lived back east then. And my grandpa drove to the side of the road and a bunch of places would scoop up mason jars full of Mount St. Helens ash. So, I mean, if this it's just so funny to me. So anyway, we're gonna fast forward to it, but it's just so funny to me. That's absolutely well played on the part of Mr. Fort.
Appeared in October, and Fort again theorizes this new star is responsible for the following phenomena. In October 1902, vast amounts of smoke-like haze of unknown origin obscured all things at sea, from the Philippines to Hong Kong and the Philippines to Australia. It was so thick it impeded navigation. This blanketing of the southern Pacific was only a couple weeks before a series of atmospheric fallouts that would not end until well into 1903. By November 12, 1902, our world had traveled along the ecliptic to the opposite side of the sun as it was positioned.
What the fuck? He did not just say that.
By November 12, 1902, our world had traveled along the ecliptic to the opposite side of the sun as it was positioned 6 months earlier in the...
Oh, God. All right, now I get to be all pedantic. Sorry, I had to rewind that because I thought that's what he said. This is pedantic. I recognize it's pedantic out the gate, but this is also, he did write a script, clearly, and he's missing, like, this shows a fundamental misunderstanding of astronomy. Our world does not travel on the ecliptic, all right? The sun travels on the ecliptic. The ecliptic is the imaginary line that the sun rises on around the world. So when he says that our world traveled along the ecliptic, that's literally the opposite of how it goes down. So again, it is pedantic, but it's also kind of understandable why has no problem taking all this stuff at face value. His understanding of astronomy is kind of low.
The month of May. On November 12th and 13th, 1902, occurred the greatest fall of matter in the history of Australia. Upon the 14th of November, it rained mud in Tasmania. There was a haze from Australia to Hong Kong, hundreds of millions of tons of matter that fell upon Australia, Pacific Ocean, Atlantic Ocean, and Europe in 1902 and 1903. Blankets of dust and sometimes mud caked ships to where all hands had to be reported on deck just to scoop and shovel mud off the ships in order for it not to capsize. As dust, dirt, and mud rained on Australia, the densest darkness lit up with glares. Fires were falling from the sky as seen through giant pockets of mud.
No, but this is go on, man. Really, really, really. It is really interesting because these are, out of everything that he's talked about, this is the coolest thing. That whole mess in Australia was pretty sweet. They had as far as crazy shit goes, they had this mud storm, and they did have meteors that fell. And so these guys are looking up in the sky and seeing mud and rocks, and yeah, it's probably felt like the end of the fucking world. And I can see why, you know, this is the kind of thing that if you were looking for evidence of some astronomical thing tearing this planet apart, this would be the best piece of evidence. So even though I think that Jason is clearly misguided and way off in the weeds, I will say that out of all the pieces of evidence he's brought out so far, that this is, again, I've read Charles' stuff before, so Charles Fort's stuff before, so I'm familiar with the stuff. But this is about the best piece of evidence for whatever craziness that Jason's about to spit at us. Again, I'm thinking some sort of Nibiru thing that he's just going to call a phoenix.
Fire from the sky fell upon and ignited the ground in every district of Victoria, even setting fire to houses. And Weishin proof. The whole air seemed on fire. Buildings were burnt in Bort, Allendale, Delanquin, Langdale, and Chiltern. This incendiary sky was followed by a rain of red dust and darkness through about 50 towns in Australia. They suffered this darkness and disasters, and for a while, little of this tremendous occurrence has been told in the publications that are said to be scientific. It has been ignored.
It's wrong to say that it's been ignored by science. It hasn't been connected. They haven't connected the rocks from the sky with the mud. So there is, they can say that they feel, if you feel like our boy Jason does, or like Charles did, that, you know, everything's connected, it all is one. Well, then, yeah, you could be frustrated that they're not. How can you not think these two things are connected? But, to me and to many other people, they're clearly not connected. So I think that's what he's alluding to by the science has ignored it, because it's certainly talked about both the mud storms and the dust storms and the meteors. So
Australian reports read that there was nothing like it before in the history of the colony, with people stumbling about blind with lanterns. On the same day, November 12, 1902, ashes with sulfurous odor fell in New Zealand. A meteorite fell at Kamsagar, Mysore, India, and disastrous flooding happened in the Malay states. 7 bridges carried away. Also, volcanoes erupted at, Kilauea, Hawaii, and on the 13th, a volcano at Savi in Samoa erupted, and at Windward Islands, West Indies, Stromboli, and Mount Chulapata in Peru. That's my best guess.
Well, somebody who sucks at pronunciation, I won't pick on him for pronunciating things worse than I would even, but this is, volcanic activity. Congratulations. Once again, this is stuff isn't, I don't understand how he's having, again, I guess I shouldn't say I don't understand. I did just see him not understand the basics of astronomy. So I do get how he doesn't get it. But I should probably put that back on the studio.
Parramatta, Australia, and on the 13th, a meteor exploded. 5 days later, on the 18th, a fireball fell, exploding terrifically at Karkor. At Murrumburra, Australia, dust and a large fireball fell from the sky. Ford notes that on this day, the new star and puppet shine at its greatest magnitude when a 6-foot tidal surge struck the coast of southern Australia. On the 20th, Sir Charles Todd Elliott Observatory reported a large fireball was seen moving so slowly it was observed for a total of 4 minutes. On the 21st, a fireball apparent size of the sun was seen at Taweta. An hour later, several towns illuminated by a great fireball or an explosion.
If current events have you feeling like this guy, welcome to the Archaics family. There is no need here to say aloud what we are all already thinking. Okay. Yeah. There's a lot of really cool disasters, and let's be honest, the one in Australia is pretty cool, and it is worth it. You know, when you've got meteors falling all over the planet, don't get me wrong, I'm not disinterested in this, but you have to have some basic understanding of astronomy and some like understanding of how this phenomena works. I'm pretty sure we're going to get some planet here. He's already been talking about it. So I don't really know what to say except for you don't listen to trolls, man.
Today, on the 22nd, a fireball passed over the town of Nangan, Australia, intensely illuminating the night and ground, and a fireball exploded at Ipswich, Queensland. The fourth cover, 344 years of documentary reports, he specifically focuses on 1902 and 1903 as particularly unique. Concerning the concordant scientific reasons of his day, he wrote in the book Low that it belongs to the Dark Age or the other Dark Age of the year 1902. Despite the knowledge of the ancient Ionian Greeks who knew that fallen stars were stones from the sky, Ford notes that as late as November 1902, in Nature Notes, pages 13 through 23, an actual member of the Selborne Society still argued that meteorites do not fall from the sky and that there are masses of iron upon the ground in the first place that attract lightning.
Oh, that was cute. Okay. First of all, yes, that would be the same Nature magazine that he was just bragging up a minute ago. It was one of the many sources. It's like, ha, ha, ha. Amazing. And, I'm only going to do about half an hour at a time, be-dunkified. Sorry, I'm doing the best I can. But, yeah, it's going to take a couple hours to go through half an hour of that. Unfortunately, that's how this stuff goes. That's why I'm doing it this way. Because I'll be less polished as I respond, but this will be way faster because I'll only have to go through the video 2 or 3 times. You can't do this with everything, right? But like, all I had to do was talk to Archaics for a little bit on the internet, and I quickly could deduce the man's fucking loony. So then I can go through and watch the video and, you know, I catch it immediately. It's like taking Charles Fort seriously. It's like that just hurts. But yeah, the whole This is the same Nature magazine that he was just talking about how great it is and what a great source it is. And then now he's talking shit about it because of the opinion of one scientist that was outdated. And this is how it usually is. You usually have a holdout or two. Science is slow to change. And as longtime viewers of mine will know, I like the quote that you get from, oh, come on, what's the guy's name? What's his face? His law, Planck's principle. There it is. Science progresses one funeral at a time. And it's, you know, the idea is that, you know, the younger generation grows up hearing these things, and so they're not such crazy ideas to them. But the older people that have grown up for 20 years with a set dogma, they're slow to change. And I'm on board with this. I completely agree with this. But it is what it is. I mean, the man's you can't, again, the really interesting stuff with the stones falling from the sky. It's one of the coolest periods in recent history. There was a lot of rocks falling from the sky there, it seems like, for a few generations, or for a few years there, excuse me. Even a decade or two, but it's still, it's a far cry from proving that there's, you know, a planet or that running on top of us, or that we live in a simulation, or that we are all the Sargasso seas in space and stuff. It's like, oh my dear God.
This ridiculous blindness brought out Fort's cynical humor. He said, "I do not know what the mind of an astronomer looks like, but I think of a fizzle with excuses revolving around it." Fort observed that scientists have perpetuated the most ridiculous notions rather than to admit the arrival of dust from somewhere beyond this world.
No, right there, you get it back to back. Fort was funny, man. That's hilarious, really. But at the same time, pretty combative. And the idea that dust is falling through the atmosphere, this is something that, again, I don't understand how how Jason can even believe that for a second. It's like you would have to have airburst after airburst after airburst, and it wouldn't just be like meteors in the sky. I mean, you would be the amount, I would hate to even, you'd have to do like math, but you talk about actual global warming at that point. You start having enough rocks explode in the atmosphere to create dust storms and mud floods. God damn it. You're talking some absolute insane amounts of thermonuclear activity. It's like we're getting attacked by the freaking Independence Day type of shit going on in order for these kinds of atmospheric debris. In order for us to have like the time that we know, I forget exactly when, but in the Middle Ages they had a few years there where there was a lot of volcanism and it really just darkened the sky, and it took so much. It took fucking volcanoes just pouring it, like not just a little bit, it took just massive amounts. So anyway, it's wild as fuck to me that he really, really, really has a fundamental lack of understanding on just like basic stuff in order to even buy into this stuff at all. So I feel really bad because I know that I'm going to get a lot of his followers down there just saying, "You're just a government shill," or probably a lot of Electric Universe supporters, which I'm working on a response to that. I'll probably do the same thing to that video, actually. But anyway.
Or as put by Charles Fort, sands from other worlds or from their deserts, red rains that very strongly suggest blood, or finding divided animal matter, debris from interplanetary disasters. Also, in his book, The Book of the Damned, he wrote, "I begin with a notion of some other world from which objects and substances have fallen to this earth. Every living thing upon this earth may ancestrally have come from somewhere else." This is amazing for conclusions that were made just from reading scientific reports over a century ago.
Yeah, if you didn't catch that, he said basically that everything came from somewhere else. And so that everything on Earth came from somewhere else, like panspermia kind of thing. And this is, I'm not opposed to these ideas, really not. I've said it before. I think I've even said it here just a little bit ago that, Mars is the planet that's, out of all the planets in the solar system, out of all planets in the universe, Mars is the one that's going to be the most likely to have life on it, have had life on it at some other point in the history of the universe, because it's fucking close to a planet that has life and has, we've got tardigrades, man. We can knock one of those things off with a big rock from space. It could rain down like dust, except for it have to ride inside of something, right? I think it's going to need a little bit of thermal shielding, but I'm not opposed to these kinds of ideas. So it's funny that he calls me a government shill, and that's really the reason I'm not talking to him right now. It's like he back and forth with these kinds of accusations and calls me government propagandist and all kinds of bullshit, and then cancels the debate and then says he didn't cancel the debate. And so anyway, I'll just respond to the guy's arguments, and in doing so, well, let's just put it this way. I haven't drank in a few nights, but if you want to meet me tonight at Mootsie's at downtown Spokane, it's going to be a day.
Thorpe believed that the things he found documented as having fallen from the sky were from the surface materials wrenched away from another world. In 1919, this was a fantastic notion. We can only marvel at Fort's own source materials once again. The American Journal of Science, the Catalog of Destructive Earthquakes, Intellectual News, Journey of the Franklin Institute, Les Mondes, Monthly Weather Review, Notes and Queries, Observatory, the Quarterly Journal of the Geological Society, Science Monthly, Smithsonian Institute Annual Report, The Victorian Naturalist, Yearbook of Facts, Zoologist Magazine. First findings and conclusions were an assault on the cherished conventions of the scientific community.
Fucking assault on the senses of common sense, man. I mean, it was the point. Yes, he definitely attacked the scientific community, but again, I don't know how many times I'm going to have to say it in this video. Fort was a troll. Okay. Fort was a troll. He had no intention of being taken seriously. He had every intention of proving that the other guy shouldn't be taken seriously. And so he'd take the same playbook and come up with just stupidity. If you've heard the term weaponized autism, this is exactly what the fuck they're talking about. He literally was being stupid in order to prove a point. God damn it, dude. Oh, Jason, yeah, buddy. Yeah, short bus riding motherfucker. Oh, gosh.
No scientist has ever upheld a new idea without bringing upon himself abuse from other scientists. Science has done its utmost to prevent whatever science has done. By way of explanation, in the Book of the Damned, he wrote, "The world of astronomers is in a state of terrorism, though of a highly attenuated, modernized, and devitalized kind. Let an astronomer see something that is not of the conventional celestial sights, or something that is improper to see, his very dignity is in danger. We are left with the impression of vast debris fields strung around the sun along our orbital path on the ecliptic. This notion is..."
Fucking there, he said it again. Damn it. We don't orbit in the ecliptic, for fuck's sake. God, gee willikers. Look, I'm gonna pull this up right now just to prove that I'm not stupid. "The ecliptic is the imaginary path the sun appears to trace along the celestial sphere over the course of the year, representing the plane of the Earth's orbit around the sun." The plane of the Earth's orbit. The plane of the Earth's orbit. It doesn't represent the Earth's orbit around the sun. It's the fucking sun's imaginary orbit around the Earth. Jesus fucking Christ. All right. Anyway, I know that, again, that's being pedantic, but you make the same damn mistake twice. It's safe to say you have a fundamental misunderstanding of the very basics of astronomy. And my dear God, when your video is all about astronomy, my shit. So yeah, I don't even know what to say.
Strengthened in Fort's analysis of the year 1903. On February 14th, Valentine's Day 1903, the blackest of darkness over Australia occurred, followed by a deluge of dust and mud upon 40 towns in New South Wales and Victoria. The material that fell in Australia fell about as enormously as that fell in the dusts of Europe. It was a tremendous blanketing of dust, dirt, and mud straight from the skies over Europe. For several days, the south of England was a dumping ground from somewhere else. Red dust fell as far away as the Canary Islands and on the 19th.
No, he's just babbling about the these connections, and the connection between asteroid impacts and the dust and stuff, I get that. But again, with the correlation and causation, you know, the Vikings, the Norse invaded England, and then they got beat up and pushed out, and then the French invaded England, and King Harold and all that shit. You can say that, you know, maybe God punished England, and I'm sure that the people that lived there at the time probably felt like that they were being punished by God. But the fact of the matter is, it was just one raid after the other. There's a number of reasons why that kind of thing can happen. It's like, you know, and people tend to look for agency in those things. So anyway, it's really funny to me that the way that he's like, his whole case is built off of this guy's troll arguments. So hopefully he comes up with something better soon. Otherwise, I don't even know if I'll end up doing a part two of this, which I was planning on breaking this into pieces.
From somewhere else. Red dust fell as far away as the Canary Islands and on the 19th. On the 27th, this fall of dust continued in Belgium, Holland, Germany, and Austria. A vessel reported that dust fell into the Atlantic midway between Southampton and Barbados. In England, it was estimated at 10 million tons of fallen matter. And again, 50 tons per square mile in Australia alone. Also, at Switzerland, Russia, and from February to March 1903, dust and discolored rains fell on the western coast of Africa. Fort wrote that the matter is variously described as brick dust, red dust colored, as reddish raindrops and gray sand, quite red, yellow, and brown. Chemists of the time proclaimed that tests of the red dust revealed 9.08% organic matter, or as much as 36% organic matter, depending on the sample that was taken.
Yeah, the red dust thing that's organic, do you think that it was an alien organism raining down from space, or do you think that it was more likely that a bunch of plankton or tadpoles, it's red, right? So Lord knows it could have been like it raining frogs and shit, that this and fish, this isn't complicated. There's winds that scoop shit up. Man, I was just the other day watching a video. These guys flew a fancy drone right into the eye of a small tornado. And, yeah, if you were a fish in the water and that fucking thing, man, you're going for a ride. There ain't no two ways about it. And you get shot up into the sky and flown around. I mean, you can see this stuff taking a while before it falls back down and coming back down as a red paste. This isn't crazy, all right? What is crazy is attributing it to, it's like coming from Nibiru or the Phoenix planet or whatever Pokemans it is that these kids are playing with nowadays.
As 1902 was called a dark age, 1903 is the other year specifically commented on by Fort. He said, I think myself that in 1903, we passed through the remains of a powdered world left over from an ancient interplanetary dispute brooding in space like red resentment ever since, unquote. Fort published his opinion that the near approach by another world to this world would be catastrophic. Also, he said, I accept that some of the other worlds are of conditions very similar to our own. I think of others that are also very different. Though the reports came from all over the world, Fort notes that the astronomers in 1902 and 1903 remained quiet, loathing to ponder an origin for dust outside of our world. While meteorologists pontificated that storms kicked up African sand from the Sahara. Fort searched the weather reports of the time. There were no storms in the Sahara, in Africa.
Yeah, it just like it took a long time for them to find the Tunguska event. This is fucking storms in Africa were the last things that were being reported. I mean, for those of you who don't know how things were in the early 20th century in Africa, think rubber plantations and fucking slave farms, all right? Things were not going on so hot down there. Nobody was running around smiling. Things were not good, all right? So the idea that, they were reporting, oh, we had a dust storm, boys, be careful. It's fuck you. But this is where, again, this is where Charles Fort plied his trade. He was playing a game with these people, man. He deliberately was kicking the tires of science. And this is why I like his work so much. But this is why it's you using it as a basis for an actual theory of anything is really, really, I mean, come on, man. This is it's like using political satire as a basis for your political views. So, I mean, it's okay.
Also shows that the sand of the Sahara is white, not red. Nor were any volcanic eruptions occurring in 1903. However, Charles Ford does note something unusual. The appearance of a new star. In Ford's book, Lo, we read, it was found by a professional astronomer upon photographs of the constellation Gemini taken upon March 8th, this new star appeared. It may have existed a few weeks before somebody happened to photograph this part of the sky. A luminary is not necessarily a star, but could just as the same be a light reflecting body, a planet, even moving toward or away from the inner solar system. Over 2 months later, on May 20th, 1903, Professor Lowell and the Lowell Observatory observed a dust cloud on the Terminator of Mars that moved 300 miles in a few days. Less than 3 months later, on August 9th, 1903, a red luminous object was observed by four persons using field glasses for over a 20-minute period. Like Phoenix, this object was moving from north to south. That is another common denominator of all the Phoenix phenomena. It was always an object that darkened the sun that had suddenly appeared out of the northern heavens, passed over the ecliptic, traveling southward to vanish again once it was off the ecliptic.
Hey, he got ecliptic right that time. Good job. Way to go, Jason. You're fucking 50%. I got this broken clock up there that's just like you. Every now and again, it gets the shit right. But, dude, yeah, there's some lore for you guys out there. The clock's broken. But this is, come on, man. I don't even know what else I could say at this point. I think that I'm probably just going to stop this video here. And I'm going to go like surf through this before I do part two of this, because he's taking the words of a fucking troll and he doesn't understand astronomy. God damn. All right. So again, we got the dust. He's talking about this dust that could be from outer space or whatever, that's, you know, it's red. It's far more likely, again, that it came from, you know, Earth. It's organic matter. It's just, come on, dude. I just don't understand how. I guess I'm wondering how people take this seriously. But okay, so as you can see, I'm wearing a new shirt now because I had to take a break, which means for some of us out there, Jason, we take showers in between, you know, filming and stuff, like once a day at least we try to wash our butts. So I did that, and now I'm here to watch some more of this brilliant content, and you know, we'll see how many times he tells us that the Earth travels through the ecliptic. At anyway, let's go ahead and continue on with Archaic's brilliantness here. Probably share screen and click this right here, and woohoo, here we go.
Along the plane of the ecliptic, like all the other planets do, like we do. Any correlation between the appearance of
as soon as he starts, he says,
come 3 months later, on August 9th, 1903, a red luminous object was observed by four persons using field glasses for over a 20-minute period. Like Phoenix, this object was moving from north to south. That is another common denominator of all the Phoenix phenomena. It was always an object that darkened the sun that had suddenly appeared out of the northern heavens, passed over the ecliptic, traveling southward to vanish again once it was off the ecliptic. It did not travel along the plane of the ecliptic like all the other planets do, like we do.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that we travel along the plane of the ecliptic. That is as close as he's been to say anything right there. But again, the ecliptic is an imaginary line that the sun rises in. So like if you were to stand in the earth in one spot, you could trace the ecliptic in a circle with your finger. So hypothetically, you'd have to draw through the horizon, but you get what I'm saying. You could draw a circle where the sun travels through the sky. This isn't complicated, but it is if you don't know a lot about astronomy, which is kind of funny because, I mean, he's trying to sell himself here as, you know, doing this hot take of astronomy, and he doesn't know the basics of it.
Any correlation between the appearance of new stars in 1901, 1902, and 1903 and the dust blanketing Earth is still a mystery. Ford believed they were connected, and so worldwide was this deluge of cosmic dust. He wrote that it was the greatest atmospheric cataclysm in the history of the world.
Sorry, this is just so, it's so painful at times. Okay. The whole point of this, if the whole idea that dust is falling from the sky onto the earth is, again, something that you can't really say and have any idea about astronomy. It's like there's the two atmospheres would have to, like, you'd have to have two planets with their atmospheres rubbing together and like melding and stuff in order to even think. I can't understand any way that dust could survive a trip through the atmosphere. So I'm really confused as to how Jason takes it seriously, but, you know, he probably thinks the dust travels the ecliptic. So,
despite the academic animosity, scientific disregard for Charles Fort's work and theories, his sources were of the highest reputability. Astrophysical Journal, Chemical News, Elements of Astronomy, English Mechanic, Leeds Astronomical Society, Journal of Royal Meteorological Society, La Nature, La Astronomie. We have memoirs of the National Academy of Sciences, Nautical Meteorological Annual, Record of the British Association, City Real Messenger, Thames Yearbook, U.S. Weather Bureau Report. These are just some of Charles Fort's documented events for 1901, 1902, and 1903. There were more in his writings. As we exist within a controlled holographic environment, the simulacrum, each
8-year
period manifests events that mirror or are linked and connected to other historic events that occurred in those 138-year episodes.
Holy fuck, man. He just took a turn there, didn't he? We're talking about all of the, you know, great sources that Charles Fort used, and then all of a sudden we segue into what? Oh, we live in a matrix. We live in a holographic universe. We live in, you know, I've been told this about Archaics' work, but I haven't really paid any attention to the guy except for to yell at him a little bit on the internet. And this is, what the fuck? I mean, okay. Let's talk about it real quick. The idea that we live in a simulation is hypothetically feasible, and then the argument, the mathematical argument, is fair. It has actually got some legs if you really think about it. Like the idea is, if we were able to create a simulation that was so good, it was so accurate that the beings that existed in the simulation, the AI, didn't know that it was AI, didn't know that it was fake. That was all. Every one of the things in the simulation thought they were real. If that was the case, how many of these simulations would we make? Would we make just, you know, one for scientific purposes, or will we end up making millions and potentially billions of them for video games and all kinds of goofy shit? Well, if the latter is the case, then it is a pretty fair assumption that, you know, mathematically, we probably don't live in the real universe. We probably live in a simulation. And that's so that there's a fair argument to be had there. However, this taking that statement as factual, you know, on a philosophical level, if you really want to have a meaningful conversation, there's a few things that you have to take into consideration in order to really have any sort of conversation about the fundamental aspects of reality. And one of those is you have to assume that we all exist, right? I mean, otherwise, this is pointless. I can say, this is all, you're all figments of my imagination. This is all my dream. You're all just my fever dream. And this is all bullshit. And I wouldn't be the first person to make that kind of an argument. However, that kind of an argument is, while it is interesting and hypothetical and it's fun to muse about, it is fundamentally incompatible with communicating with another human being on any sort of meaningful level. Otherwise, I mean, if I just assert that this is all fake, well, now why does any of it matter, right? And so this is why, you know, people with these kinds of attitudes could even end up committing certain crimes.
This means that the widely documented occurrences in 1902 are holographically connected to all the prior Phoenix destructions, and this fact is further demonstrated in the unfolding of events in 1902 that Charles Fort did not document. Here are events in 1901, 1902, and 1903 intrinsically connected to the Phoenix history. The Cincinnati Astral Society published a prediction that a new comet would soon be discovered and that it orbited an unknown planet. This happened in 1902 with Comet Morehouse, photographed as it broke apart, and the scientific community theorized at the time that it did orbit an unknown body, not the sun.
All right, I need to look that one up, because that's the case. Well, let's find out what we got here, because that sounds like crap to me. Comet Morehouse was discovered in 1908, all right? So, like, I don't even know what the fuck he's talking about here. He's just making shit up at this point or completely getting stuff wrong. I'm not really sure, but no matter how you slice it, that was ridiculous. I mean, this is... Yeah, Comet Morehouse was discovered September 1st, 1908. So this is the kind of stuff where, I mean, you know, you can get things wrong, but if your whole case is like on these 138-year cycles or whatever, you kind of need to make sure you get your dates right for these things. Now, when I looked, there was a comet that broke up in 1902, but it didn't say anything. It was just called 1902B. And so, like, again, this kind of stuff is important. If we all get things wrong. Don't get me. Don't. I've made plenty of mistakes on this channel, but this is the kind of thing it's fundamental and kind of massive. He's repeatedly just getting facts wrong.
And he published a prediction that a new comet would soon be discovered and that it orbited an unknown planet. This happened in 1902 with Comet Morehouse, photographed as it broke apart, and the scientific community theorized at the time that it did orbit an unknown body, not the sun. Interestingly, also in 1901, the Astral Society predicted that a gigantic passenger steamliner would sink between Britain and the United States with a loss of life, primarily due to inadequate lifeboats, which did occur 10 years later or thereabout with the Titanic.
All right. Now, I know a lot of people believe in psychics and, you know, the predictive power of some people, like guys like Edgar Cayce, do get enough right that, you know, they're still wrong more than they're right. Nostradamus is a great example, wrong more than right, but they get enough right where you have to scratch your head a little bit, right, and wonder what's going on, especially guys like Edgar Cayce, who didn't really make any money off of it and seemed to be really plagued by the whole thing. But when you've got psychics making predictions that are like, you know, all you had to do in those days was have been on a boat and been worried that it was going to sink on one of these liners. And you'd probably notice that there was a shortage of lifeboats. The Titanic wasn't the first one that they didn't bring enough lifeboats on. This was something that, you know, they standardized after the Titanic. So it's, in my opinion, it makes a whole lot more sense that somebody, you know, just made an educated guess than it does that they were psychic. And another thing there is, you know, he attributed these people to, you know, predicting this comet, and it's the wrong one, comet, and it's another, you know, 9 years away or 7 years away. It's like, man, these... just kind of make shit up as we go along, right? You can't really tell me you've got this hard and fast case if you're just kind of like fudging things and moving the pieces where you want them to go. But if your audience doesn't fact check you at all, you'll probably end up looking brilliant.
In May, Mount Pelee explosion that killed over 30,000 people in a blast of superheated gas is widely known. It was also mentioned in passing by Charles Fort, but what happened afterward is not widely known. Quickly after the volcanic explosion, it was noticed by the scientific community that plants and animals returned to Martinique, but were much bigger than usual, exceptionally sized plants, animals, and insects. Even the on-site researchers, Dr. Jules Gravure, grew 2.5 inches taller, and his assistant, Dr. Ron, aged 59, grew almost 2 inches.
All right. So looking into this, it seems like there is, you know, reports that seem to be unfounded. I can't find anything that shows definitively that this is what those people even said at the time. So given Jason's track record so far, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that he's conflating. What happened was there was this spire. He showed it there on the screen, that little spire of basalt. That grew up out of the fucking volcanic eruption. So that was growing quickly. That grew inches a day. But like, Yeah, this is the kind of stuff that it's, you know, it's hard to understand how people fall for this stuff, because he's there's definitely things that are anomalous in the record that researchers have told us that have been passed down, but like in this case, I'm not seeing it. I see it on Facebook posts and stuff, the kind of thing where it's like, oh, so and so said blah blah blah, but it's unfounded stuff. I mean, it meme research, right? And I'm fucking sorry, we don't do that in these parts.
Interestingly, Martinique had previously been visited by Christopher Columbus. In 1902, a volcanic eruption covered the ancient Olmec site of Abaytakalik. The Olmeca, as shown in our prior videos, were wiped out in a Phoenix cataclysm, and their final date still marked the year 31 BC in our calendar, which is a Phoenix visitation year. In 1902, Sir Norman Lockyer's research on Stonehenge was complete and published in his book Stonehenge and Other British Stone Monuments. The site destroyed in 2239 BC and again in 1687 BC, Phoenix catastrophes, both times re-erected by locals and mentioned many times in our prior videos.
If we've got something that's coming along every 100 and some odd years and it's doing a wiping out of humanity, you need to be accurate with your stuff. You need to be accurate with these dates. So like 1901, 1902, 1903, but actually it could be 1908, you know, it might be 1912. It could be the Titanic even. We'll just shoehorn that in there. It's like, dude, okay. Well, at that point, you know, well, the Civil War, we'll just shoehorn that in there. Yeah, I know it's 100 years off, but it's only 100 years off, right? You can't, you start just allowing yourself to fudge the data any way you want, and then you end up with the fucking Earth traveling along the ecliptic.
Minoan Crete, the city of Knossos in the Mediterranean, excavated from 1901 to 1903, a civilization that was destroyed several times, including the catastrophic resets of 2239 and 1687 BC by the Phoenix phenomenon. Again, our prior videos cover these topics. Just seconds after being sighted by the crew of the ship Algonquin, the SS Bannockburn vanished in Lake Superior in 1902.
Like in this case here, like as I watch the video and see that, you know, he's referencing this Phoenix stuff that he's talked about in the past, I had to go and look a little bit. And basically, yeah, he believes that some planet comes by and rips us apart every 100 and some odd years. And this is okay, sure, if that's really what you want to believe, but you're not going to. I would like to say you're not going to convince anybody, but he has convinced enough people that it is ridiculous. This stuff doesn't make any sense. Let's just put it that way. The math that we use to launch a satellite into space so that I can talk to you people right now through the magic of the internet. That same math is going to tell us that we can't have a planet passing that close to the Earth. And again, he's, you know, I could go through and pick at each one of his little things, all the Minoan civilization on these dates. I guarantee you that he's getting shit, that he's moving shit around a little bit in order to make it work. We've already seen it. So what I'm going to do here is we're going to go ahead and pause for a second, and I'll jump to a different spot in the video where he starts getting into other predictions and stuff instead of just this repeating of catastrophes, because like we went through with a bunch of this already and just citing catastrophe after catastrophe after catastrophe and calling it evidence. And then when every time we scratch the surface, quite frequently anyway, the data is not quite right. It's like, I don't want to go through all that with a fine tooth comb. Suffice to say, I'm not convinced by the haphazard manner that he cites this stuff. So, all right. So now I think we're going to talk about Nostradamus and the pyramids a little bit. That sounds more interesting than just one thing after the other getting destroyed by Nibiru or the Phoenix or whatever freaking Pokemon card we're playing today.
Pyramid of Giza. The blocks of this monument in Egypt are made of geopolymers, made through a process in which artificial stone is created that is virtually indistinguishable from natural rock. The limestone casing blocks of the Giza structure contain opal, CT hydroxyapatite, a silico aluminate not found in the quarries, blocks containing numerous trapped air bubbles.
Okay, this is just bullshit. I know enough about this. I don't need to look. This is bullshit. The outright bullshit. the limestone on the Giza Plateau, the limestone that the Great Pyramids are made out of, the casing blocks, these are, they have identified the quarries that they came from. They know where they came from. All right. This can't be argued. This is that you, the people that claim that the Great Pyramid blocks are geopolymers are fucking nuts. All right. This is straight up out there. Yeah. You're not even making the least bit of sense. You're not doing basic research. Okay. So I'm not surprised that I'm finding him in the same category with that Marcel Foti guy, who is another nut job, you know. And just the same as Jason here, they might be on to something, a kernel of truth. Like as I've said many times, Sir Isaac Newton today would be rejected outright because of his love for alchemy. So they would be like, you can't be citing all that crazy theory of gravity shit. That's goofy alchemist craziness. So I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But damn if that baby is small when you're saying things like the Great Pyramid is cast from geopolymers. It's like, dude, just fuck. Okay. There's so much evidence to the contrary. It's and you barely can even address it. Who the hell's texting me right now?
Organic fibers have accidentally fallen into the mixture and they had been found inside the stone blocks of the Great Pyramid. But you're not going to read this in the official establishment literature of the time. You're not going to find Zawi Hawass admitting this to anyone.
No, you won't find Zawi Hawass admitting this to everyone. And you won't find this in any of the literature. Not the mainstream literature, not the nut job literature. The only literature you're going to find this in is fiction written by guys like Jason here. Nobody on God's green earth that's tested those blocks has ever said anything like that. Now, if you want to look for geopolymers, go to Pumapunku. You might actually get somewhere there. Those blocks look cast, and call me crazy, they've actually tested them, and some scientists have said that they may well be geopolymers. You won't find that on the fucking Giza Plateau. There's a big difference. And as a guy who has argued with Zawi Hawass on the old Piers Morgan thing, I have to say, you know, I absolutely would say that Zawi is the kind of guy that's going to dismiss mysteries and brush them aside. He's going to do the same thing Jason's doing, okay? He takes one piece of evidence, for example, a scroll that's a papyrus that says, we worked for Khufu and we brought these blocks down the stream. And Zawi will take that and say, this is proof that they were building the pyramid. Now, it doesn't say they're building the pyramid, but they were building for Khufu, and what the fuck else would it have been? It's not like Khufu built a whole bunch of other stuff. So they just attribute it to the pyramid. And he does this in a couple places. The graves of the workers, same thing. Pyramids. Like, that's not the case. You're extrapolating without proper data. You're taking what you do have proof for and assuming that it's proof for this. When you have the debate raging that we do, that's kind of bullshit. But it's the same thing that Jason here is doing, except for in this case, he's not even doing that. He's doing it with other stuff. But in this case, he's not even doing that. He's I don't even know where the hell he got this claim, but it's fabricated as fuck. But got me swearing, boys. Goddamn.
The greatest evidence of the geopolymer construction of the Great Pyramid is the magnetite. When liquid rock cools, all the magnetite has time to point toward magnetic north, but not the geopolymers of the Great Pyramid and other ancient structures from the Old Bronze Age. They used the process of liquefying limestone, adding in composites that would harden it, and then they would cool it artificially fast, too fast, the magnetite crystals to align toward magnetic north. This is what we find. The magnetite is all in disarray.
Here it's Dan from the future or the past. I'm editing the video, and I noticed that I misunderstood what he said there. He was talking about the magnetite itself. I was thinking about the magnetic polarity of the blocks in general. So magnetite does align itself to the Earth's magnetic field when it gets a chance. So like if in a limestone block, it would cool and line itself up with the field, which is a matter of fact, is something that other people that believe in geopolymer pyramid construction point out, that the magnetite seems to be aligned to the magnetic field from right there on Giza, like the blocks were poured in situ. Now, I don't believe that that's the case either, but what's funny here is that on both extremes, we have either a claim that the magnetite is perfectly aligned with the magnetic field from where it sits, and we have the claim that the magnetite is just all in complete disarray. Neither one of these seems to be accurate from what actual mainstream science says. And now, as those of you who watch me know, I'm not a huge proponent of like everything that mainstream science says is accurate. However, when everybody's got a dog in the fight, I'm gonna end up going with the one that is the least controversial. Provide me more evidence, sir. We can talk. But as it is, this guy takes trolls seriously. So what do you want?
Sir Flinders Petrie, 100 years ago, found abundant evidence of a drilling and boring technology employed in the structure that was beyond his ability to understand, but he documented it nonetheless. But a century later, Christopher Dunn recognized that these builders used ultrasonic drilling with diamond tip bits. Petrie's measurements are published in his book, The Pyramids and Temples of Giza. His measurements are accepted by Egyptologists and especially by Zawi Hawass, the head of Egypt's Antiquities Department.
Ah, Petrie's famous drill core number 7. Yes, this is interesting stuff. And you do have to give Christopher Dunn credit where credit's due, even though I think that Chris, he takes the ancient high tech way further than I would. You do have to give him credit where credit's due. He reinvigorated a lot of the looks into the ancient precision. A lot of what Ben Van Kirkwick's work on the vases has come from, it's a direct descendant of Christopher Dunn's work, who is a direct descendant of Petrie in this regard. However, there's a lot of debate about how these drill cores were made. They've demonstrated it, and it's not complicated. You can take a copper tube and put, hard sand under it and then rotate that and make a drill core, right? You can bore something out. Now, this is where they debate on like the lines, the stratification into how the tooling was done. And it ends up being, ultimately my point here is the claim that this is just, these measurements of Petrie's are accepted by Zawi Hawass. This is not true. Sir Flinders Petrie's, his measurements, they get frequently get revamped and revised. One of the biggest things is the way that he measured the perimeter of the pyramid and stuff. A lot of times they will come in and kick the tires on that. So Sir Flinders Petrie's not a bad guy. He was a bad guy in a lot of ways. He was not a bad person to follow into the Egyptology thing. He was very much like the dude that kicked it all off and really opened the doors of mystery into these things by actually like looking at stuff and asking the questions. I mean, there were people 100 years ago buying precision vases from ancient Egypt that knew what they were looking for because of the work of Petrie. So it's definitely worth acknowledging, but to say that Zawi Hawass and all of that crew just accept his measurement, no, fuck no, man. Again, basic research would show Jason don't really know what the fuck he's talking about.
In 1646, the monumental research of John Grease was published titled Pyramidography, or A Description of the Pyramids of Egypt in England. He was then made the professor of astronomy at Oxford. This was the scientific world's first true examination of the Egyptian relics and great pyramids. Over two centuries later, in 1859, John Tedder completed his own work, The Great Pyramid. Why was it built and who built it? The book was published and became a sensation in the year 1860. The first book to theorize that the Great Pyramid was of biblical import, that it was a prophetic calendar erected by the biblical patriarchs. Unfortunately, his work was scoffed at by the Royal Society. Because the structure was located near ancient Egypt, they assumed it must be Egyptian. Taylor was the editor of the London Observer. Inspired by John Taylor's work on the Great Pyramid mysteries, Astronomer Royal for Scotland, Charles Piazzi Smith, traveled with his wife at his own expense to Egypt, where he took careful measurements of the Great Pyramid in late 1864 and 1865 during the American Civil War. During his study of the structure, Smith became convinced of the Great Pyramid's biblical import. His findings were published in 1880 in his huge book, Our Inheritance in the Great Pyramid. At this time, Robert Menzies developed the theory that the pyramid inch and its length represented a single year in world history. Every measurement of the monument made
was in pyramid inches, which is very interesting because the unit that he found is exactly one fractal of the 365.25 days it takes the Earth to go around the sun.
But yeah, let's talk really quickly about the numerology stuff here. Now, when you take into account that Jason believes that we all live in a simulation, that unified theory of everything stuff that I was talking about yesterday or earlier in this video, however you're watching it, this is kind of, it kind of makes sense that he would be, you know, you see this, they incorporated this into that and that into this. And basically, it makes a whole lot more sense that it's all, everything's put together in this perfect little form. And then we can make a perfect little, the pyramid inch aligns with the cosmic year, which is going to, I know that he believes that like 1 month is 1 year and kind of thing in different historical things. And that Atlantis happened like 1300 BC. And it has to do with, his whole idea about it's Phoenix and Nibiru shit. This is, you know, I guess if you believe that we all live in a matrix and you believe that we all live in an artificial reality, this kind of stuff makes a whole lot more feasible sense. But even then, it's like, I don't know about the rest of you, but I've seen nothing in my experience on this planet that inclines me to believe that everything is intertwined in this magical way like this, where I mean, there's definitely overarching themes and stuff. Like you mentioned fractals, and fractals are certainly something that life does, that the universe does. There's, you know, there's the Fibonacci sequence. There's all kinds of things that you could say that seem to be like a underlying theme-ish. But this whole idea of looking for the programmer's code like this, you're going to have to be meticulous in your data. You're going to be very meticulous in the way that you're looking at your data in order to make these kinds of cases. But that's the problem with true believers. They don't have to do meticulous research. They just accept it. And then anybody who kicks the tires on their arguments, a CIA plant, and, you know, therefore not to be trusted. So, arguing with these kinds of people can be very difficult. And I mean, you can see the charts and stuff that they got there. It's like he presented. You can argue all kinds of mathematical things, but especially when you start incorporating pi, you start incorporating the golden ratio. I mean, I did a bit a while back talking about like in them encoding its hidden messages into the vases. And it's the same kind of thing where it's just like when you start taking numbers like pi and the golden ratio, you could pretty much make anything you fucking want. You can pretty much make anything you want. I use it to prove that Sony did 9/11.
It's the research of Robert Menzies was absolutely fascinating for the time. Smith quickly adopted the view of Menzies, even producing evidence to support it. However, Taylor, Smith, Menzies and those thereafter, like David Davidson, all employed inaccurate chronologies of the world or inaccurate measurements of the Giza structure, which caused the pyramid inch theory to fall into academic disfavor.
Honestly, he just rejects the data that doesn't align with his predetermined position. He's going, of course, those measurements are wrong. Of course, the timeline was wrong. Why? It doesn't fit into his worldview. This isn't how you find truth. This is how you reinforce your faith.
They made obvious mistakes and I've even made the same mistake of applying current events and misdating prophetic material. And they did it to the extent while using the physical measurements of the Great Pyramid that it was really easy to disprove them. David Davidson was an English engineer who sought to prove Robert Menzies wrong, that the Great Pyramid was not a prophetic calendar of historical timeline in stone. He extensively studied and measured the monument and completely changed his mind. His own mammoth book, The Great Pyramid, Its Divine Message, with Egerton Sykes, ended up supporting Menzies, Smith, and Taylor, but added a wealth of new supporting evidence. By 1926, his book was famous.
All right. It's important to note that just because a researcher changes their position when they look into something doesn't necessarily mean that there's nothing to see there. To give you an example, you know, Mark Lehner, Zahi Hawass's buddy, Yeah, he was put through school by the Edgar Cayce Foundation because he was an Atlantis bro. He believed that they were going to find some crazy shit when they started investigating ancient Egypt. And then he starts investigating ancient Egypt, and now he's mainstream as it comes. So if I was to use Jason's logic, mainstream academics are absolutely right about the pyramid. Don't believe me? Look at Mark Leonard. Zahi Hawass himself. For those of you out there who want something interesting, Google Edgar Cayce Foundation, Zahi Hawass. You'll be fucking blown away. That dude has spoke at the Edgar Cayce Foundation. When Zahi was arrested for during the whole Arab Spring thing, the Edgar Cayce Foundation, oh my God, he's not going to make it to next year's thing because he's in jail. Dude, Zahi Hawass and the ECF are buddies, okay? Have been for a long time. So, again, the whole idea that just because somebody changes their mind because they do some research, that just means that that person changed their mind. So it's not evidence one way or the other. You got to do your own research. And you have to be accurate with your data.
Pyramidology in 1957 that also added much more evidence of the pyramid calendar theory. All these men were correct in their theory, but corrupt in their calculations. Graham Hancock and Robert Bovell, two authors that I have a lot of problems with. But putting that aside, they had a stroke of genius, and this is what they wrote. In The Message of the Sphinx, in Appendix 3, they come very close to understanding the purpose of the Great Pyramid's holospheric function, not its engineering purpose, don't get them confused. They wrote that the function of the Giza blueprint is to provide a virtually indestructible holographic apparatus. Living man is the result of the holographic union between matter and spirit. It would very much appear that the followers of Horus, Shimshu-Hor, understood the cosmic mechanism to somehow re-separate the two. The construction of the amazing holographic starstone apparatus of Giza. The Giza interior is definitely a blueprint. Now, this is me now. The Giza interior is definitely a blueprint that is linked to an interface with the holosphere we are immersed inside is very true. That it serves as a cosmic mechanism is also correct. But Hancock and Bovell do not even know anything about the Phoenix chronology. None of their multitudes of published books even hint that they are aware that our world is on a fixed 138-year timeline going back to before the flood. And that many biblical events fall perfectly in sync with this 138-year timeline.
Oof. All right. Look at that. So, okay. We've got Graham Hancock and Robert Bovell are crazy, but they've got part of it right. But they don't know anything about his 138-year timeline that, you know, uses comments that are 7 years out of date to reinforce. But you just, you know, don't buy it with that. It's 130-ish year time. A century-ish, century, whatever the hell it takes, he wants to insert. This is what we're looking at to begin with. Second of all, the position that Graham Hancock and Robert Bovell take as far as in The Message of the Sphinx, for those of you who aren't aware, we're talking about the Orion-Giza correlation. The idea that the Giza plateau is locking a date, a fixed date by the stars. And some people say this is crazy. Some people will say that this is outlandish as the stuff that Jason posits. But, you know, if you look at the Hoover Dam, the guy that made the Hoover Dam put a star chart in it, the engineer or the architect in charge put a star chart in it where if you are a good astronomer, you can calculate the date that that site was dedicated. It's been done. It can be done. It is feasible. It's hypothetically possible. And on the Giza Plateau, it does line up. If you take the three stars in Orion's belt, you take the Sphinx, you take the Nile River, all these things align at like 10,500 BC. And in all honesty, one of the best bits of evidence that I can hand you for that information being compelling is other astronomers like Vincenzo Orofino, who is an archaeoastronomer, who has looked into this, and he's got a different position, but he still accepts the Orion-Giza correlation. He thinks it's a fourth dynasty correlation that lines up with mainstream Egyptology, but he believes that Orion and Giza are correlated, and he's got even more evidence, like an inverse correlation between the magnitude of the star, the apparent magnitude, which is how bright it seems to from Earth, and the size of the pyramid. The brighter the star, the smaller the pyramid, and it follows a steady gradient. It's not just haphazardly, this one's bright and this one's dim and small. It's very much a formula. And this stuff is interesting and has been a lot more worked on and evaluated than Jason's position. Now, that doesn't mean Jason's position's wrong, but the hubris that he has, the arrogance that he has, the self-assuredness is a huge problem that I have with his whole take. You can never trust anybody who's 110% on what they're saying, because they will fudge the data because they think that it doesn't, the ends justify the means, right? We see this a lot for mainstream science when they just come out and bullshit us about things because they think that it's going to make us all fall in line and do things like good little kids. And they'll just, you know, whatever the fuck it takes to make these guys fall in and do things properly. For example, Dr. Robert Schneiker, I believe his name is, but he was on a live stream with Flint Dibble and who else was on there? That Dan Falou guy. And they were saying that Flint asks this geologist why he got involved in the Sphinx, because he's weighing in on the Sphinx weathering. And you would think that the geologist, Dr. Schneiker, is like, oh, well, you know, I looked at it and I was compelled because blah, blah, blah. Oh, no. He's like, well, I see that, you know, you guys are debating with all these pseudo guys, and I felt like a first responder on an accident scene. I just had to do something. All right. Can't really trust that motherfucker's data, right? He's already just told you why he's here. It's not here to find the truth. He's not here to espouse the truth. He's here to change the narrative. Anybody there to change the narrative can't be trusted. That's not to say that changing the narrative is inherently wrong. My point is, if that's the whole reason you're here, if the whole reason you're doing something is to push a narrative, whether it's to change it or to maintain it, you can't be trusted. You're a fucking ideologue, not in this for the truth.
The following data is unknown to them, which only makes me appreciate their observations even more. The earliest traditions of the Great Pyramid of Giza are not Egyptian and assert that it was designed to endure through a cataclysm. That it provided a basis of knowledge for future generation was its purpose. Internal measurements scientifically conducted by Sir Flinders Petrie of the rectilinear subterranean passage widths, chamber heights, passage length and ascendant passages easily provides a uniform unit of measurement that was used by the constructors throughout the monument. These measurements were discovered over a century ago and were conducted to disprove the wildly popular pyramid inch theories of the time. These measurements are scientifically acceptable today, absolutely precise, and they are arranged in rectilinear lengths of 138, 552, 1518, 1656, 2070, 3036, 4140, and 5796, every single number divisible by 138, the orbital period of the Phoenix object.
All right, this is bullshit math games. This is bullshit math games. Remember, he rejected certain measurements and he's clinging to other measurements off the gate because some of them fit his bullshit math game and other ones don't. I'm sorry. I don't have there's no question that there is, you know, some mathematical stuff that was encoded in this, that, and the other thing. And I don't question that some of that was considered esoteric knowledge and whatnot. But this is the kind of stuff that, come up with an idea, you've got the 138-year cycle of the destruction of the Earth, and now you're going to shoehorn the pyramid to fit as the edifice that tells you all about this. So you take the sets of measurements that you can make to work with it, and then you shoehorn those in. The Egyptian cubit, fuck that noise, even though that's what the pyramid was measured in by all accounts. Oh, no. That's them hiding the truth of this from us. In reality, it was that one guy who made measurements that aligned with Jason that had it right. Everybody else is full of shit. Again, I can't take this shit serious, man. It's impossible to take serious. You have to be willing to kick the tires of your own argument before I'm even going to look at it and do anything but just kind of roll and tickle and be tickled by your silliness.
Meticulously illustrated charts of the interior of the Great Pyramid exhibit precisely multitudes of measurements, all divisible by 138. We must conclude that the builders of the Great Pyramid of Giza were aware of the Phoenix object, and this awareness allowed them to know when it would return over and over again. We also conclude that the world of the Sethites, of Enoch, and later Abraham was not the primitive society that we have been led to believe.
I'm going to make some people upset here, but we got to talk about the Book of Enoch a little bit. The Book of Enoch came out like after Christianity. It's an old book, but it's not really old. It's certainly not remotely as old as it's given credit for. And they can tell this by the writing style. They can tell this by the things that it references. Now, the Book of Enoch is really interesting. If you've read it, man, it is a wild read, and there's definitely some astronomical symbolism in it. There's no question. Gates in the sky and freaking demons that communicate with Enoch. But it is, again, I know I was going to make some people mad, but the book is not remotely as ancient as it's said to have been. It was one of those creations to capitalize on being... Just like those people that are like, oh, man, I interviewed an alien at Area 51. What's your source? Trust me, bro. The same kind of shit that just pops up out of nowhere. Now, there is a lot to be said about the mythological times of, like, Abraham and stuff. I mean, there's a lot of interesting symbolism in these days. There's a lot of interesting ideas. And there's no question that the Bible does tie in heavily to a lot of these, you know, it references Egypt a lot, right? The Bible and our ancient history are intertwined, but it gets put on a pedestal quite often. And I think this is one of the examples of it. How do you put it? It's just another ancient book in my mind. Staying out of being in an ideologue land, you got to put it, it's just another ancient book. There's no reason to value what it says any higher than any other ancient book. Now, I know that some people are Christian or otherwise are going to disagree with me on a religious level, and that's fine. But you have to, I hope that most of those people would be at least willing to admit that their faith is the reason. It's not because of actual evidence. The evidence can get a lot different for different people. Like what we see, I've heard a lot of people say evidence for God is like, look at the trees, man. Just look at the trees. That's evidence. Look at the beautiful river. Look at the sunrise. How can you tell me there's no God? And it's like, if I'm seeing, I already seen sunrises, bro. I've seen the fucking trees. Now, if it didn't convince me before, you think you pointed out to me? Oh, people have different standards of evidence, and I get that. But this is putting the Bible on a pedestal is something you see a whole lot of people that have come out of Christianity, and they're trying to understand, trying to reconcile and maintain their worldview that this book is somehow more important than other books, even though it's. It's got a fucking talking snake and a talking donkey in it, man. I don't know what else to tell you.
Great flood of 2239 BC did not catch them unaware. They prepared for it. These measurements prove the Phoenix object will return to visit great destruction on our modern world in May 2040. The sixth seal of the apocalypse of the biblical narrative in the Book of Revelation, which was borrowed from the older Greek Sibylline oracles, is the subject matter. It is the end game for whatever this Phoenix repetitive destruction is.
Ooh, yeah. Okay. What can you say? If that's, you know, that's what it takes. That's where his belief system is. We are going to be. I'm glad I didn't bother debating the guy, because it would have just ended up being an argument about fundamental stupid shit. It'd be like, why should I take this seriously? Well, because it's the Bible. Hey, fuck. And now we're going to go to Edgar Cayce. And like I said earlier, you know, Edgar Cayce's probably, out of all the psychics out there, he's one of the ones that I'd give the most credence to. But even he, I don't give credence to psychics. There are anomalous things like Edgar Cayce's, the kind of thing where you scratch your head. You're like, okay, well, it's weird that it seemed to really fuck his life up and he still seemed to keep running with it. So in that regards, it's a little anomalous, but come on, man. How I can't use that shit as evidence. I no reasonable person should. Come on.
Popularly as the sleeping prophet is accused by many of being a medium of witchcraft, God-touched, demon-possessed, a formerly illiterate simpleton whose mind is in touch with transdimensional beings that divulge to him secrets. Whatever the case may be, he has been right many times in the diagnosis of ailments of his neighbors and scientifically documented case studies where Edgar Cayce nailed exactly what somebody was suffering. And he did it through dreaming.
That is correct. Edgar Cayce did dream, and that was how he saw things, and he did diagnose a lot of ailments successfully. He was also wrong quite often, more than he was right. But, you know, he seems to have been a true believer. For all the writings and stuff that you see, it seems like he was a troubled soul that believed what he was doing was real. So, you know, but again, how could you put it? Say, for instance, he was great at divulging if somebody was sick or not. That doesn't mean that he's going to be good at, like, predicting other things and whatnot. It's, anyway, these sources of evidence are the kind of things that I can't, you know, they're great corroborating evidence. Sure, you could say, but Edgar Cayce also predicted this. But, man, this isn't going to convince me of jack shit.
What Edgar Cayce says about the Great Pyramid, which is a subject matter he should know absolutely nothing about, is amazing. He said the Great Pyramid is a record in stone of the history and development of man to the end of the present Earth cycle. Its records are written in the language of mathematics, geometry, and astronomy, as well as in the kinds of stone that are used after the end of this cycle. There is to be yet another change in the Earth's position. That is amazing.
Amazing? How the fuck's that amazing? No. Edgar Cayce was wrong about that, right? I mean, according to Archaic's position, okay, for those of you who aren't aware, Edgar Cayce was a believer in, like, the long year cycle, right? He was a believer in, like, these 20,000-year cycles, 10,000-year cycles, very long cycles that were astrological in nature, not 138 years. But we'll just ignore that, right? We'll just, again, he's cherry-picking the data that aligns with his perspective, and he's disregarding all the other stuff. So, yeah, Archaics is a joke. I certainly won't need to go through this entire video in order to prove that. But, Archaics, his position is never going to convince anybody who's skeptical. It's only going to convince people that like to listen and have their, that sounds good, tickled, and they do not scratch the surface. And those kinds of people, it's just a matter of who gets to them first now, isn't it?
Says that it signifies the return of the great initiate for the culmination of the prophecies. All changes that have come and are to come are shown there in the passages of the Great Pyramid from the base to the top. Changes are signified by the layer of stone. Again, this is fascinating. In my own book, When the Sun Darkens, and in Chronicon, I show that the terminal date for the basement of the Great Pyramid ends in 1902. And this is by many different mathematical computations. What's fascinating is that 1902 to the year 2106, which is the 6,000th year from the beginning of the pole shift of 3895 BC, which was started by Phoenix.
Pole shift? 3500 BC? Oh, come on. Fuck. Let's look this up. Yeah, just as I suspected. All right. This will be, I think we can pretty much put his shenanigans to bed with this. I'll talk to those of you who are, or access to the live stream after this for a few minutes. For those of you who don't have access to the live stream, when I film videos like this, I'm doing it live, and then I'm editing it afterwards. And my Patreon supporters and my YouTube channel members, well, they get access to me live, so they get to see me being an idiot and flubbing over things and filming them a second and third time. And then they get to see the behind the scenes stuff of me coughing and taking hits off of my cigarette. But the point that we're trying to get at here before we segue too far off the rails is this guy is making shit up. catastrophic pole shift. There's zero evidence for that. As a matter of fact, 3500 BC, we don't have like an absurd amount of written records from back then, but we have plenty of astronomical records from those times, and they don't fucking show nothing like that. All right, this guy is ignoring things like the Lissot Caves. He's ignoring, he thinks it's fucking probably 5,000 years ago. The guy's, he's got this goofy idea about time and about everything else. Again, if you believe we all live in a video game, yeah, you just fucking make whatever argument you want, right? And at that point, I've got no use for you. You can't, you're just making shit up. And if the data points that you use are cherry-picked so heavily that you got a tree full of apples and you're only taking one or two of them down because the other ones all have worms in them, dude, you got worms in the ones you're holding to. This is bullshit. So anyway, I think that'll probably be the last I deal with Jason. I'm sure that some people will leave comments down below to tell me I need to look into X, Y, and Z, and I will do that. But this is painful. This is bottom of the barrel pseudo intellectualism, and it's crazy. Okay, it's easy to line things up. It's easy to line up numbers. It's easy to line up images. It's easy to line up ideas. The thing is, if you have a picture in your head and the data that doesn't corroborate with that picture, you just fucking throw out. And the data that does corroborate with it, you hold up and put it on a pedestal. Got no use for you, man. Got no use for you. You are exactly the kind of person that Charles Fort would have made fun of for doing shit stupidly, for being an idealistic person who claims to practice science. Thank you very much for watching. I'm going to be in Sedona, Arizona in just a few days, May 1st through 3rd. Don't forget to buy tickets down below and support the channel and all that other stuff. And appreciate it. Hope to see you next time.